The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. MyBills.ie. Help save time with bill payment online for free. Unpost. Do more. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. Visitors to the UK can get sterling commission free at selected post offices. Unpost. Do more.
Hello there, and a very good morning to you. And you're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning. Now, if you want to know what is universally in all of the papers today, it's Brian O'Driscoll, Brian O'Driscoll, Brian O'Driscoll and Sadie O'Driscoll, actually, and Amy Huberman and the family, and there's great celebrations of what was really a terrific occasion yesterday in Lansdowne Road in the Aviva. The only thing that annoys me is everybody's talking in the past tense. You know, there's a future tense here too, and it's going to take place next week in Paris. Let me go through the rest of the headlines before I come back to introduce our guests. Now, Sunday in Doug, there's the photograph of Brian O'Driscoll and his daughter. Revealed, the daughter completely unfazed by all the chaos going on around her. Anyway, revealed the 165 million splurged on experts. Flannery must go before PAC. Fine Gael minister demands explanation for 77,000 lobbying fees paid by Rehab. And Gore the watchdog, why did I not get any whistleblower reports? The Sunday Business Post, patients at risk due to drug dose errors. Now, that'll put a little bit of fear in people's hearts. There's a photograph of Mr. McKillen, he who has been fighting with Barclay Brothers for a long time, and he says the Barclay Brothers are snookered now. And cabinet documents show strong opposition to Riley's UHI plan. The Sunday Times opt for a photograph of Amy Huberman and her daughter Sadie on the front page. Their main story is Kenny offers tax cut for pay freeze. And set us free, say Saudi sisters. This is about two sisters. They're the daughters of King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. And apparently they've been held against their will for the past 13 years. And they're growing old kind of in front of them, of one another, and nobody's aware of their situation. They're looking for help. The Mail, the Irish Mail on Sunday, another picture of Brian O'Driscoll and his daughter, and Rehab cruelly dismiss disabled workers is their main story. Charity said it was no longer profitable to employ staff despite huge taxpayer subsidy. The Irish Sun on Sunday leads with a photo and the headline of a Sadie farewell. And the other story on their front page involves another sports person who is AP McCoy. Tells us that the champion jockey yesterday spoke of his difficult Cheltenham build-up after his baby son Archie had a heart operation. Sunday World, Dad's All Folks, the Bodfathers, Brian's emotional farewell in his last home game. And John Traynor is quoted as saying, I didn't try to get Gilligan whacked. There's a lot of coverage of the same Mr. Gilligan right across the papers today. This Sunday Mirror leads with a story about two little girls being raped in Athlone back in September. As you know, the man who pleaded guilty to that was given two life sentences earlier this week. Daily Star, photo of Brian O'Driscoll with the headline, Aviva Darcy Drico. But they lead with a story about the ex-EastEnder actress Daniela Westbrook. And the headline, Hate Mob Drove Me From Home. Now, let me introduce our guests to you this morning. We're joined by Ursula Tipp, partner with Tipp McKnight Solicitors, Hélène Conway-Mouret, French Minister, Minister Delegate for French Nationals Abroad, Peter Murcha, The Irish Times, Colm O'Gorman, O'Gorman even, Amnesty International, and we'll be joined later on by Ben Tonra, who is Professor of European Foreign Security and Defence Policy and Assistant Professor of International Relations at UCD. But we will go to you weren't at the match yesterday, Peter, but you were watching it.
I was watching it like probably an awful lot of the rest of the country, and it was a great occasion. It was wonderful. Wonderful result. I suppose what strikes me, I agree with you, by the way, that it's not over yet. We've got a big weekend next weekend. Yeah. But I think what struck me most was, apart from the said young Mr. O'Driscoll's skill on the field and the
making. He was in good shape.
He was terrific, yeah. The making of those tries. And his character comes out in that and his professionalism. But his personality came out in the interviews afterwards. And he's there's a very endearing aspect to him. There's a modesty there. There's a self-effacing. He doesn't take it too seriously, but he acknowledges that people do love him.
Yeah.
And he just comes across very, very well. And what is he, 34? So there's many, many more years. And who knows what contribution he'll make to his country.
I remember doing an interview with him when he was just heading up to 30, and he was talking about going to 30 like as a big milestone,
yes,
and that you have to take looking after your body seriously, which he did apparently to keep him going. You were watching it on Twitter. How can you do that?
Yeah, it's a bit of an oxymoron, isn't it? I was walking yesterday. I was taking part in an event to mark International Women's Day with the NWCI in O'Connell Street. So the best I could do was try and follow it as best I could on the live report on the RTE news app, and then follow it on Twitter, which is always a bit of a nightmare. I have to say that I'm sorry now to be terribly shallow, but for me, looking at the papers this morning, the first thing that struck me was, could you not? Wouldn't it just make your heart go all a flutter when you see either pictures of Amy and Sadie or Brian and Sadie? I mean, God Almighty, aren't they just gorgeous? when you talk about they're just beautiful, beautiful pictures. And there's something, as you said, I think what's so lovely about Brian O'Driscoll is just the simple humanity, niceness of him.
Yeah.
He's just such a lovely fella.
Out of the man. And for all his extraordinariness, there's a lovely ordinariness.
That's
as well.
Right.
He's one of us.
Yeah, you kind of figured that he kept the old feet on the ground.
Yeah.
Now,
next Sunday, huh?
Next, you are hosting our Thánaiste, is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
In the Stade de France.
Yes, and looking forward to it. I think the Irish are going to go in with a huge motivation to win. And what we saw yesterday was just brilliant.
Right.
Of course,
you ever waver in your loyalty?
Well, of course, when the Irish are playing any other team than the French, of course, I support them.
Yes.
But then it's difficult. But at the end of the day, I win, because if the French win, I'm happy. If the Irish win, I'm happy. So, but I agree with what you're saying. I think they're beautiful people. The humility that's coming out of this great man who has been a role model for my own son, who started playing rugby in Greystones at the age of 6. So I spent a lot of time on the touchline myself, and knowing all these rules and seeing a beautiful play yesterday. And what's going to happen next week, I think the French are going to give their best as well, and they're going to enjoy the way the Irish play, and we're going to have a fantastic match. I'm really looking forward to it.
I know it's going to be an absolutely great occasion, and one should keep focused on
Let's
that.
Let us know if you have any spare tickets, will you?
Well, not yet. No, but anyway, I think Brian O'Driscoll is a role model for the young people, and that's what our youth need today. They need to look up to people who are just good at what they're doing, who give them a wish to do as well, and make them feel that, yes, there is something to be done, whether in sport or anything else. I think we need a little bit of hope, and that's what Brian O'Driscoll is
representing. Yep,
absolutely.
Yep, true. Now, going to the other, there's a, by the way, when I was talking to you about the thing, well, I think we actually can hear that piece from an interview that I did quite a while ago. If it's there, if it's not, we'll come back to it later.
I think the game is becoming more and more professional, and there's a smaller margin for error. With each year that we the professionalism passes on, I think people are getting fitter, getting stronger, getting harder. The hits are getting bigger, so it's definitely a case of making sure that you look after yourself, and certainly as someone that is breathing in down the throat of 30 years of age, I'm someone that goes and understands that I need to get myself ready for games by certain criteria, and that's something that you have to appreciate with a bit of experience.
There you go. Now breathing down, 30. But anyway, good luck to them all next week. Now the papers today, actually, I gather, Colin, when you looked at them, you made the remark that they're very similar to the papers for the last couple of weeks.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? Well, if it was only the last couple of weeks, the last couple of months. I mean, the front pages of a lot of the papers, I mean, two of the major stories across them are obviously in relation to charities in relation to rehab and questions there about funding, and the other in relation to ongoing questions about the Gardaí and questions of accountability and transparency there. And it just strikes me, actually, even as you go through the papers, and not just in those areas, they really do reveal how poorly we've gotten to grips with those two principles in Irish life generally, principles of accountability and transparency. You know, that we have to almost drag systems screaming into some measure of reasonable transparency. And I mean, how much longer is it going to take to get to the bottom, for instance, of the story proper transparency in the funding of services by the state and the health or education sector, funding arrangements and structures within charities and NGOs? It's extraordinary. I mean, I think this latest rehab story is staggering, I have to say. You know, how somebody who's a former CEO of a charity ends up on the board of that charity is very closely linked with Fine Gael, with the lead party in government, and then ends up being paid €77,000 to lobby on behalf of the charity. It's just so messy.
But I mean, isn't there loads of precedent here for people who have been in office and then they go out of office and then they become lobbyists?
But if you're neither in office nor out of office, and you're all, I mean, whatever about that. You have situations where, and again, we have to be clear here, we don't know enough about this story yet to form a firm view of anything. I think that's part of the problem, the drip of all of this. But, you know, the individual involved, Flank Flannery, is neither in office nor out of office anywhere. He's in all kinds of places all at the same time, and there doesn't seem to be any particular clarity about why or in what context he's there, or what's the relationship, or what's funded and what isn't. I have to say, you know, advocacy, political advocacy, is a key part of the work of most NGOs. I mean, Amnesty International, we're essentially a campaigning and advocacy organisation. But the idea that within the sector you would be employing professional lobbyist organisations to carry out that work strikes me as
But don't
as
you
very,
have
very
to
odd.
Lobby?
We do, but we do it at a staff level, and we do it where the systems via which we lobby and carry out our political advocacy are clear, through which the pay and reward systems for anybody who works within the organisation are also clear. I mean, for instance, it's generally accepted that people who are on the boards of charities should never be paid for their involvement or engagement with those charities. Indeed, in the UK, it's against the law for anybody. It's contrary to charity law to be paid and to be a director.
I thought it was the same here.
Well, it's all a little bit unclear. And of course, the problem with an organisation like Rehab is that they're both charity and not charity. You know, so there are elements that are. So that's one. And to be fair to Rehab, I mean, that's a failing in how we've generally provided for
services.
Governance and not just services, but also governance in the not-for-profit sector. But, you know, organisations need to decide what they're about. Are you commercial or are you charitable? And if an element of your work is commercial, well then, what are the measures in terms of both transparency and accountability for what happens within the profit element of your organisation, and how is pay and reward decided there?
Right.
I mean, it's very messy. And, you know, I'm not saying this from the point of view of, you know, a major concern for the charitable sector. It's just very, very messy.
Peter?
I think I agree with everything Colin said. I think the interesting thing, and perhaps not quite as sort of pessimistic as perhaps you are, you know, you talk about the same story coming around again and again and again. Yes, that's true. For a number of years now, lots of programmes like this and others, and in the political sphere, there's been a lot of discussion about transparency and accountability.
Yeah.
And I think the first thing to say is, great, we're actually talking about this now, because things have been wrong for many, many, many decades through an absence of accountability and transparency. So that's the first thing. I think in relation specifically to what the Independent and hats off to it has done today in pulling together all this 165 million splurge, as it says, on consultants, what it's done is shining a light again on this area. And the question that comes up in my mind is, there seems to be very, very little openness about lobbying. There seems to be, we need a register, we need to know who's involved,
well, the same
what's
problems
going on.
In Washington,
but at least in Washington, they actually do something about this, and influence peddling and all of that sort of thing is actually, first of all, it's frowned upon. Secondly, you can find out about it much more, but we don't know for instance, who's going in to see minister this or minister that to lobby on proposal X or Y, and
well,
what effects they have.
I'd say, for example, that the IFA or the ICMSA or all these people go in before the budget and they do their lobbying. Yeah. Like, it's kind of nearly an annual event.
Sure. They're easier to track down. They're sort of established, if you like, professional or trade union representative organisations. They represent interests in society. But there are lots of individuals in the consultancy area, in the PR area, who will represent vested interests in the private sector, who are in there doing the same thing. And we know very, very little about it. Very little.
Well, okay, I agree with the point he's making that we need absolute transparency in those areas. And sometimes that can be very difficult to get because, yes, you were right when you said what happens prior to budget every year. All those organisations like IBEC, other organisations, they write in and will make their view known. And that's important because, you know, the way certain groups in society should have their voice.
And very often and publicly.
Yeah, it's done publicly. Oh, yeah, very publicly. But it's also important that it's done because we have a number of vested interests in the various areas, and governments at a time need to know what do all the various sectors want and are well informed about the various views. But what is not in order and what is questionable probably for the moment is all this underhand lobbying when people do not come out what side they're standing for.
How does it operate in Germany? Do you know?
Okay, it's for you mean now for the charitable sector?
Well, both.
Because you see, the charitable sector, I think, in Ireland, and for the moment, they are in the process of reforming the charity sector, you know, from a legal perspective. And I think that was long overdue. Because in other countries, like in Germany, that's much more governed. You know, the way so corporate governance, I would put all this under. It's much more strictly regulated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to come here and all these...
I think the charities want it.
Exactly.
I mean, it's because... You see, for the moment, it's hurting the industry. It's hurting it's hurting the charitable industry enormously because they all, like when we like Amnesty International, when we were talking earlier, he was mentioning to me that they had all their figures up on the website and stuff. They are thriving for transparency because then people who donate to these charitable organizations know where is the money going. That a part of the money has to go to administration and certain things. Everybody understands that, but it has to be transparent. And I think that's now where this whole thing is heading, because otherwise, at one point, people won't donate any longer, and we cannot have that. That's important.
Can I come to you, Helen, as a minister? You see that story that Peter was referring to there in the front of the Sunday Indo about the 165 million splurged on experts. Would you, as a minister in the French government, do you hire in expertise from outside, or do you have it within your department?
Well, we have it within the department. We don't have the same system. And I agree with everything that's being said about transparency. I think today there is a gap between the political world and the people. And there is really, I think the people are crying out for more transparency, and old ways have to end now. What was acceptable 10 years ago is just not on anymore, because we've all gone through a very deep and difficult financial crisis, economic crisis, every crisis. I think the people have given an awful lot, and they want to know how the money is spent now, how their money is spent. So we are pushing ourselves, I mean, at the European level for more transparency. And that's why I found it a bit strange this weekend being here at the time where the EPP was meeting in Dublin.
Yeah.
And thinking that Mr. Juncker was reinvested by their own, its own people or its own political family anyway. This is a country that has always fought transparency at the European level. And when we are actually trying to get rid of all this fiscal paradise, what we call, they are within the European Union itself. And I think we all need now to, from a political point of view, have a very hard stance and start you know.
Yeah. Actually, I know this is a side issue, but it's a big issue for our listeners and for most Irish citizens. And that's all this money and banks and bondholders and the whole lot. And one of the things that came up during the week was Emily O'Reilly was talking about openness, transparency, accountability in Europe. Everybody down in the convention centre saying, look at me, how open and transparent I am. We want to see the letter from Jean-Claude Trichet to Brian Lenehan. Would you agree that we should get it?
Oh, yes. I would be absolutely yes. I think once something comes up that much into the open, you're better off putting the cards on the table and the facts, because we're not trying to find something, you know, the way which aren't the facts. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's a letter. It's in writing. Yes, absolutely.
Helen?
Yeah, well, I don't want to interfere in any way in Irish affairs. We have enough of our own scandals and everything. So, but yes, I think there's everything to be won, to put everything on the table and as I say, get rid of some old ways that are just not on anymore. I think the people in Europe have gone through enough and they want to know how their taxes are being spent within the states and by the people in power.
As I understand it, actually, I don't think it's just an Irish issue. As I understand it from listening to Emily O'Reilly during the week, this was blocked by the board of the ECB. So it was blocked, and in her view, for purely political reasons.
Well, so, she thought it might have been for good, sensible financial reasons at the time.
Perhaps at the time, but that time has passed. But also that, that there had been, she believed the letter was about to be released and then that was blocked, again, I understand from the interview, by the board of the ECB.
Yeah.
And she felt that that was essentially a political decision. Now, that's not a political decision that was made here in Ireland, obviously.
Yeah.
It's a political decision that was made at the European level. And I have to say, I think that the one thing, of the very many things that the Irish people are due after the last 5 years, is absolute transparency about how we ended up in this situation and what was the deal and what was the pressure at the level of Europe that bounced or otherwise the Irish government into signing up to
we would like
taking
to
on that level of debt. We're due it. We deserve it.
Yes, we
just. This may have been made by the board of the ECB, but as I understand it, and I'm not an expert on this, we have a seat on that board.
Yeah. We do.
So how did our central bank representative vote on this issue? Yeah. Did it come before the board? We should know that as well.
Ben, you...
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that transparency and we have that right to know the decisions that were taken in our name and those decisions that had impact on us. The only thing I'd suggest is, I mean, for example, taking the Irish Independent, the Sunday Independent headline of the splurge. I mean, let's not lose sight of the priorities here, because some of that so-called consultancy fees included things like furniture removals for diplomats, the making of sandwiches for meetings. So I think we need to focus what is consultancy and what are consultants and what that really means for the practice of public policy. The transparency, absolutely no question, it all should be open and available. But the real problem is this question of inside, outside government, the use of influence, the paying for influence. That's the heart of the matter. So let's not get lost in terms of the macro number, which includes a lot of very mundane stuff, and focus on the things that are really important.
And also in Ireland, because we are such a small country, one of the things that happens, and this has come up before, is that some of these recipients of consultancy contracts are within their own firm advising competing interests in government.
Chinese walls.
Allegedly. Allegedly Chinese walls.
We also need to recognise that there is very often a need to bring outside expertise into government. I mean, again, looking at the fact that we are a relatively small country, if you look at many of the criticisms that were made, for instance, of the political systems within the civil service, particularly within the Department of Finance, it was about a lack of specific expertise. The reality is it can often be a very, very good idea indeed to bring in independent or even purely outside expertise. And very often you'll do that in by bringing in consultants. So we shouldn't allow the notion of bringing in consultants and bringing in expertise to be a bad thing per se.
But if you have
I think as everybody is saying, it's transparency.
If you have the transparency about what the contract is for, how long the contract is about, and everybody have access to information and know who's involved, then I think you're absolutely safe.
Yeah, sorry, Helen, you didn't clarify. Do you as a minister or does your department do that, bring in...
No, within foreign affairs, we don't. We have our own diplomats who are sent on a specific mission when we actually need to make changes and so on and seek out the information. They actually consult themselves, but bring back the information to us.
Right, so it's from within. And in Germany?
Oh, I do think that governments use outside consultants as well, yes. Mm. And I would think probably the French government to a certain
extent. But Bercy probably does.
Because you see, it depends always how do you define consultant again? You know the way, so you probably get two answers. I think everybody who's working in any sort of international field needs some sort of consultancy. Work being done.
Yeah, but traditionally mm-hmm. it would have been from within a department. Like, yes. say, the Department mm-hmm. of Health, they would have had expertise within, or the Department of Finance, mm. they would have had expertise within.
I think the notion that you might need to look outside our civil service system for expertise in the development, particularly of new initiatives and new ideas, shouldn't be that much of a shock to anybody. You know, mm. if you stay within a system, and, you know, and again, this isn't casting aspirations or saying anything negative about civil servants generally. But civil servants generally, you know, there are a lot of generalists within that system, and they move from department to department to department. If you look, for instance, at the development of universal health insurance, which is a story that's in the paper, there's no doubt about the fact, if you look at the Irish health system and at the various, I think, fundamentally flawed attempts that we made to reform that system mm-hmm. since the foundation of the state, it's clear that we need to be bringing in significant expertise to guide and inform that. Yeah, good expertise is a good idea.
But I mean, Micheál Martin had more reports
So I'm not talking about reports that get in that allow things to be then stuck mm-hmm. on a shelf and say, well, we had a report. We're talking here about, it's about the what's the purpose, the clarity of purpose. Mm. Why are you bringing in outside expertise to do what? What are the terms of reference under which somebody's employed? What's the nature of the contract? Mm. How did they perform? Also, what's the tendering process? Who are the consultants?
Yeah.
You know, if what we see is that generally speaking, there's a couple of firms or individuals who are providing
an awful lot of consultancies,
that's perhaps an issue. So it's transparency.
You want to go in?
Yeah, no, I just think with a consultancy, as long as it's clearly defined what a department or somebody needs, you know, the way fresh information or fresh help with, then I think there's nothing wrong, because consultancy is such a broad issue, and I don't think we should be now saying, oh no, we shouldn't have outside a consultancy, because one thing you have to understand, people within a department or within certain will be very busy with doing already a lot of things, and sometimes it might be good even bringing an international from a different country, mm. somebody who looks at something with a fresh view or something. So I do not think that there's anything wrong that can be good, as long as it is clearly defined what these people are doing, and that it's like everything in life, value for money, that you're getting something which then within the organisation can help. And in that sense, I don't think there's something wrong with it.
Yeah, just on the universal mm-hmm. Health insurance, mm-hmm. originally we were supposedly going after the Dutch model. Now I believe we're going after the Dutch model and the German model.
Yes.
What is the German model?
Well, one thing with the German model is it is more expensive. Let's say in Germany, a taxpayer will roughly pay 10% of its salary in health insurance. So it's fine to say, oh, we're going after this model or that model, but one has to see that. But
of the total salary?
Yes, of the total. So it's a quite a large amount of money which is paid over for the various health insurance benefits one has. And it's not just hospital cover. Guess? It's also cover for, you know, the way if you have to go you have to recover from a certain illness and you go to a specialist clinic afterwards. All that is covered. So there's a lot covered. OK, so you're getting a lot.
You get your GP?
Some of it, yes.
Right.
You get your GP and the transfer also to these other experts. You see, in Germany, here you always go to the GP first, who then refers you on. Mm. Whereas in Germany, you also have direct access to the other experts. So you don't always necessarily have to go to your GP first.
All right.
Okay, so it's slightly different. So you can say, I have something wrong with my heart or I feel. So you go to a heart specialist directly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And generally speaking, does it deliver good service?
Okay, there have been a few reports done, and generally I think the German system is seen as a good system, that the health service is, it's I think, quite an efficient service, for example, in treatment of difficult diseases like cancer. I think it's worldwide ranked quite highly.
Right. And do you have waiting lists, or do the Germans, shouldn't you've been here for years, but do the Germans have waiting lists like we do?
I don't think, no, not to the same extent. I don't think, because I think you have access to certain specialist treatments quicker. But I would like to say one thing, because if you try to compare, for example, the German health system with the health system of Ireland, you have to understand Germany is such a large country.
Yes.
So you know the way you can have, let's say with 80 million people, you can afford afford to have a specialist center for specialist cancer treatment of or rare diseases in various areas. And then, yes, by plane or train, you are from Berlin. You can go to that specialist center in Munich quite easily, whereas we in Ireland could probably not even develop such a specialist center. We are too small of a nation. So you have to see that a little bit.
You can't bear that in mind too. At 10% of total salary, that's a very, very big budget. Yeah. Can I just come to the French one? Because we were always told the French one was perfect, but I've been reading recently that it's cracking a little at the system, at the edges. What is the system in France?
The system is a bit similar to the German one in so far as taxes are paid. And
specifically?
That's part of one of the lines that you have on your...
on your payslip.
On your payslip, yes. Being deducted, of course. But then it's part of the public services. I mean, it's part of, you know, having good roads, good hospitals, good education. And, you know, the French are paying for that. But for the health system, there's been, yes, indeed, pressure on the public hospitals for some time now with a lack of doctors and nurses. A lot of people coming from abroad, in the same way as you have here in Ireland. And, of course, a large country with a large population and, of course, you know, pressure on the health system with people maybe taking more care of themselves. But at the same time, it's still free medical and dental care. And if you go to your GP, you pay, I think it's €23 now for a visit to your GP, but you're reimbursed for that visit and for the medicine that may be prescribed. So it's still a good system, but where the pressure is, it's in the public hospitals now today.
Right. And are there delays?
There are no waiting lists in the same way as there are here. Again, it's the larger country with, you know, a public service that has been in place for a long time, but the pressure now because of the sheer number of people who need to be attended to.
Ben, what's the current state in the States of how it operates there with Obamacare?
A very difficult transition into Obamacare. A number of the benefits that were promised as a result of the Affordable Care Act aren't actually coming into operation until 2015 and some in 2016. And as you know, the Republicans, particularly now they have a majority in the House, are continually proposing legislation to try to abolish what they call Obamacare, or the Affordable Health Care
Act. How does the Obamacare work? I mean, in theory, even if it isn't in...
Well, what he tried to do was sort of square a circle between single payer and the private sector, and it's a circle that doesn't lend itself to being squared. So he's created quite a complex system of both federal and state level markets, in which if you get a large enough spread of people participating in the market, the insurance industry has said that the premiums will be quite low. But it depends on a lot of very young, healthy people signing up either to the state markets or to the federal market, through which then people with, you know, serious health challenges can get insurance at a reasonable rate.
And the problem is, like the system here, then.
As I say, it is squaring the circle between the private and public. And as you say, both the German and the French systems are, you know, purely public. So that's the big philosophical choice that has to be made. And in Obama's case, his problem has been that the website he set up to sign people up to the federal market collapsed ignominiously in October, November, and is only back up online. So they're falling behind in terms of the number of people who are registering, and they need to register to make the system function effectively.
Right. You wanted to cut in there?
No, just to say that there is not only a public system in France. There's also private hospitals.
Same in Germany.
And in fact, more and more people from abroad are coming to be looked after in those private hospitals in France, very similar to what you have in Germany, with specific treatments being given. But there is a private sector in France that's booming, actually, and doing very well.
Public sector, which
But also you have private providers providing services within the public system, as I understand it as well.
Yes.
So it's not.
Contracts.
So there are contracts. And that's the model that's also being proposed here, is that there'd be a range of providers and indeed a possible range of insurers, some of which would be private.
There's not in the French system. Even the specialists are still within the public sector.
Within the public system, yeah.
They can charge more, and it's up to the people who go to be attended by these people and then pay the difference themselves and not be reimbursed by the state.
But if you pay the difference, do you get seen earlier, quickly?
No, but you're reimbursed on the basis of the public charge that would have been applied.
I don't understand that.
if you go to a GP and the fee is €23,
yes,
you're reimbursed on the basis of €23.
Right.
If you go to a GP that wants to charge €50, well, you pay the difference.
All right. Yeah, well, that seems
perfectly reasonable.
Reasonable enough.
I mean, that question about how much one might contribute, I mean, the notion of 10% of total income going towards healthcare, it'd be interesting if we, and I mean, this is one of the problems, we can't possibly gauge how much of our total gross income, never mind net income,
well,
is going towards healthcare. Because we don't have that kind
lot.
Of care. Well, but if you're paying, if you're paying tax at the higher rate, which anybody earning over €32,000 a year will be here at the moment, then actually, once you add everything up in terms of total taxation, you're paying over 50% of your income after that amount in tax. I mean,
this would have to be extra. As I understand, what is proposed is that this will be extra and it'll be compulsory.
But my point is, we already spend a huge amount of money within our health system. And one of the things that we have to do before we simply lurch into extra costs being incurred for a model of universal health insurance is identify and address how is the money that we currently spend being spent. I mean, at one point, the budget in health in this country was $16 billion a year. I don't know what it is now. It's significantly less, but it's still a very, very large amount of money. And the key point is, regardless of what model of funding is brought in, until we get to grips with having in place good systems that are outcomes focused so that we know when we're investing in health services, we're focused on health outcomes and the decisions on resource allocation and service delivery are being decided on the basis of good evidence,
et cetera,
et cetera.
But Colin, people don't feel that security now.
But of course they don't, because our current system doesn't have it, which is why we see huge flaws with, you know, with the development of a new model.
I think that's partially why people are scared about the new model, because the combining of all the health boards was handled like a shambles.
Yeah.
And the service...
And we don't have, I mean, right now we're being told, if you look at the front pages of the papers today, and some of the Business Post is running a piece to suggest that there's a very, very significant cabinet resistance to the universal insurance model that James Reilly wants to bring through, and indeed that the Labour Party may be about to pull support. You can't simply bring in another funding mechanism if you haven't begun to look at the big systemic issues within how you already currently deliver health services. We're now being told the government are going to publish a white paper, which, you know, frankly, is a nonsense. It's not a white paper. A white paper is normally a detailed plan for how you're going to do something. In reality, it's a green paper, a framework for how that will happen. The delivery on what seemed to be a very clear commitment in the programme for government is a very, very long way off. And I think you're quite right. People don't have confidence in what's being proposed as meaningful reform because they have no information. It lacks any credibility if we don't have a detailed plan. There seems to be significant political disagreement about what the outcomes of this would look like. And we still don't have particular confidence in the current system that we have. So simply coming up with a new way of funding it that people are going to have to pick up the tab for without beginning to identify how you've radically reformed the system of delivery to make sure that it's outcomes focused, that it's for the benefit of the people who need to access the service first and foremost. I mean, those are some of the big challenges.
OK, they are indeed. Can I just remind our audience, with us in studio today, Ben Tonra, Colm O'Gorman, Peter Murta, Helen Conway-Murray and Ursula Tipp. And before I go to the break, I just want to read a couple of calls that came in. I think the whole country went gaga for Brian O'Driscoll yesterday. I sat in my chair and cried like a baby. I had to slap myself and reminded myself he is still with us. Yes, he was. Yes. Another one says, but a great ambassador would make a fine president in time. I wouldn't hold your breath on that, just at the moment anyway. Brian Driscoll, wonderful rugby player, probably the best we've ever had, but please let up and have a sense of perspective. And that's from Limerick, and we'll take a break.
1850 715 150.